After graduating from the University of Pennsylvania, Cheryl Della Pietra lived with Hunter S. Thompson in Woody Creek, Colorado, where she worked as his assistant for several months in 1992. Her new novel, Gonzo Girl, is about a young woman who, after graduating from Penn, moves to Colorado to be the assistant of a Thompson-esque writer named Walker Reed. The book is a hair raiser. So what is true and what is fiction? To find out, we welcome Cheryl Della Pietra to the roundtable this morning. Cheryl, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
What led you to tell this story, number one, and number two, to tell it in a fictional format?
Well, I always knew it would make a great story. Hunter S. Thompson sort of led a singular life, and the experience I had out there was certainly singular in my life. And the reason I chose to fictionalize it as opposed to writing a memoir, first of all, I was 23 years removed from the experience, so I didn't want to quite have to rely on my memory to pull together something very linear and based 100% in the facts. But also, you know, Hunter S. Thompson has a very interesting quote. He said, "Fiction is a bridge to the truth that journalism can't reach." And I've given that quote a lot of thought recently. You know, I think by fictionalizing this story and giving myself the freedom to write it in this way, that perhaps I came to some deeper personal truth about the experience, in that I got to say what I wanted to say about it instead of just recounting events.
You're 22 years old. You've just graduated from
University of Pennsylvania,
and you get a tip that Hunter S. Thompson is looking for an assistant, and you are urged to apply. What was that process like of applying for such a position?
Well, it wasn't exactly a straight-up resume and cover letter, but I did write him a letter. It was a little bit more unconventional than say, if I were applying, you know, for a regular position. But I faxed it to him, which gives you some idea of the technology we were dealing with at the time. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, he called my apartment. I was living in New York at the time. And I, you know, fumbled out of bed and got the phone, and there was the voice. "This is Hunter S. Thompson. You know, got your letter. I liked it. Can you get out here tomorrow?"
Wow.
So I woke up the next morning, and there was a plane ticket waiting for me, and thus ensued this great adventure.
And you didn't have the job at that point, right? It was a trial period initially?
Correct. So when I went out there, there was a 3-day trial period just to sort of see if I could, you know, hang out and if I could, you know, handle the situation. And then after that, he invited me to stay. So I went home and got my bags, and I ended up staying for almost 5 months after that.
What was your job? You are there in Woody Creek, Colorado, and you're pretty much on the compound?
I'm on the compound. I lived in a cabin next door to his house on Owl Farm. I lived with his personal assistant in a small cabin, potbelly stove, the whole nine. And I would be called over to come write, and sometime in the late afternoon, and he wrote all night. He stayed up all night to write, and then would go to bed sometime after sunrise.
So your job was basically to get him from whatever he was doing to a typewriter?
Correct. The corralling, as it were, yes. the loose rule was hands on the typewriter by 2, and that was 2 o'clock a.m.
How much of that should we view as an audience as eccentric versus, you know, a little nutty, or even sad?
Which part? Do you mean his writing habits? Or
not so much the writing. Well, I guess the writing habits, but I mean, as far as that, you have to get a man who obviously is you know, he's partying hard, and you have to get him to a point where you say, okay, it's now time to work.
Well, I think it's fairly normal in that most writers tend to procrastinate and put things off and try to avoid the typewriter computer at all costs, even though you know you have to do it. So I don't think it was that unusual, but what was unusual, I guess, was what he did in the meantime, which was, you know, lots of substances and getting in the hot tub and shooting guns and and that sort of thing. You know, I do think when you said sad, I do think, you know, he was certainly not at the peak of his powers at that time. I think arguably Hunter S. Thompson's peak of writing when it was the perfect storm was the 1970s, and I was there in the early 90s. So certainly I think he experienced some frustration around his writing at that time as well.
So in this character of Allie that you write about in the book, similarly from just from college and looking for adventure and gets the job with this notorious writer. So Allie's job is to get pages, and that's very difficult. And also she is trying to earn his respect, and often in that trying to earn his respect, also partakes in much of the drinking and the gun shooting and the drugs and so forth. How much of that was your story?
A lot.
Yeah.
A lot. You know, there are a few lines in the book, When in Rome, and it really, I mean, you certainly couldn't go out there and be a teetotaler. I mean, you were sort of, you know, I felt a little bit sort of thrown into the machine out there and had to, you know, fully be present there in what was happening. So maybe part of writing this book was finally giving myself some remove from that experience, the hindsight of 23 years of life lived, and maybe, you know, analyzing a little bit what that was about for me.
In the grand scheme of things, you didn't do the job that long. So was that your decision, his decision? How did that work out?
I ultimately left. You know, the experience itself was just so utterly intense. I honestly don't know how he sort of kept everything up as long as he did, that kind of lifestyle. But ultimately, I found that I really needed to separate, you know, emotionally, psychically, physically. It just became too much. And then, you know, there are also these ideas, you know, at that age, you're sort of trying to make your own name. And certainly any ambitions that I had were subsumed during that time to what I was doing for him. So ultimately, it just felt like the right time to leave. But we parted on very good terms. And actually, when I came back to initially Connecticut, I did an outline for a second book for him for a month. That also was not published, but we did remain on good terms. And I saw him for the last time when he was doing a signing for the Rum Diary in Union Square in New York, and I waited in line like everybody else with my book, and I got to the front. And when he saw me, he grabbed me, and he threw me across the table, and he started giving me a noogie, and he ended up inviting us out that night with his group. So that was a really nice memory.
Where do you see his genius and what he was able to accomplish in his writing? What do you see as his genius and what he was able to accomplish in his writing?
Well, I do think, you know, a lot of people only know him from Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which obviously is a seminal work, but I think his genius is in his political writing. And he's so politically incisive. I mean, in 1965, he predicted that Ronald Reagan would become president. And I think that's pretty remarkable to have that kind of, you know, prescient, you know, thinking. The day after 9/11, he pretty much called everything that was going to happen, that, you know, we would go to war and who would be with. And, you know, this is, you know, the world had its collective jaw on the ground, and he was off to the races, kind of analyzing what it meant and where we would go from here, and he was pretty much right on. So his political incisiveness is unrivaled, I believe. And one of my favorite books of his is Campaign Trail 72, which you really see it all coming together. You know, his voice, the humor, the interest in politics, and that's one of my favorite books of his.
I want to get back to something that you mentioned a moment ago, that after being there for several months and keeping up with that and finding it to be so intense, you have to think of what it's like for him to live it every day.
Absolutely. I couldn't believe it, and it's still very hard to believe. just the sheer volume, you know, of substances. And I think there are maybe, you know, three people in the universe who have that kind of constitution, and, you know, Keith Richards and who knows who else. But it was truly unbelievable. And, you know, everybody always asks me, was that exaggerated in his public persona? And I have to say, absolutely not. Mm. So, yes, pretty unbelievable.
There is sort of a caricature-ish look at him, thanks in part to Gary Trudeau and Doonesbury, but you do look at that character, and in many respects he lives up to that.
He does, but I will also say that his public persona was one thing, and I do think there are, as you say, these kind of cartoonish or caricature-like aspects, even in you know, Johnny Depp's portrayal in Fear and Loathing in Las
yes.
Vegas, and as you say, Doonesbury. But I do feel like I was, you know, privileged to witness sort of some of his more contemplative moments. I mean, he certainly was a very thoughtful and intelligent person. And, you know, he woke up and had coffee like everybody else. You know, publicly, you know, before this word was a thing, I'm not even sure this is conscious on his part, he did do some public branding of himself. You know, when we went out, it was like putting on the armor, you know, the aviators, the Tilly hat, the cigarette holder. He knew people were watching him. So in the book, I think I say something to the effect of, you know, these are things that he thought lent him anonymity, but they really just telegraphed his presence, you know, like a neon sign. So so I do think some of it was calculated. I do think he understood that he was viewed in a certain way and wanted to uphold that image.
Obviously, his story is a sad one when you think of how he passed. And it does have a tragic ending. When you heard the news, were you surprised at all?
Sadly, I was not surprised by it. It was very, very sad to hear it. And I'm not sure what the quality of his life was at the end. So I don't know all the whys, you know, in terms of why he did it that way. But it was extremely sad. But if he, you know, I think his suicide notes had something to the effect of, you know, no more fun. And that was such a priority in his life. As complicated as his portrayal is in the book, ultimately, he wanted to have fun every day. And if that wasn't happening for him, I can imagine that was very sad.
And it was a self-inflicted gunshot wound. And you write a lot in the book about his fascination with guns, and you took part in that as well. What is it, do you think, that fascinated him about them? And given the way that he passed, how did he regard them?
Probably a little bit of a personal freedom angle on that, you know, like I think he certainly felt like he had the right to own a gun. And I think arguably we can say that they do lend power. I actually haven't given that too much thought beyond that. I had never touched a gun or seen one before I had gone out there. And when I shot them, I certainly understood the allure. But I'm not quite sure why he was such an enthusiast beyond those two ideas I have about it.
When you were writing the novel, how much came back to you in the sense of remembering little things that perhaps you had forgotten earlier of that time? And again, a rather brief time of working with such a larger-than-life character.
Really interesting question, because when I was writing it, I had a lot of sort of visceral, you know, reactions. There was a lot of every day out there could feel like walking on a tightrope, like you didn't know sort of which way things were going to go. The highs were very high, the lows were very low, the rages were very, you know, angry. And then he could be sweet and charming and such a sweetheart. So, you know, a lot of that bred some anxiety, you know, being out there day to day, like what's coming my way today. And I did feel some of that when I was writing, the uncertainty that every day sort of brought, not knowing what to expect. But I do look back on this experience with extreme fondness, and I do hope that that comes through in the book. It really was the ride of a lifetime, the experience of a lifetime, and it obviously made a lasting impact on me, even just this brief snapshot on my life.
Well, the name of the book is Gonzo Girl, a novel. Cheryl Della Pietra, thank you very much for being with us and sharing the story. Great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me, Joe. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is Gonzo Girl, a novel. It's published by Touchstone. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.